Expanding Mind with Eric Davis, Thursdays at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, and we're going to open up another door into the cultures of consciousness, particularly on this show. I think we're really going to be opening up, or at least peering around the lintel of some interesting doors. I was thinking about one of the interesting things that's changed over the last 50 years in entheogenic culture and psychedelic culture, is that when you read accounts from the 60s and 70s of people's psychedelic experiences and the kind of language that people had about otherworldly states of mind, there's a tremendous emphasis often on the self, you know, on higher levels of being, on maybe seeing into unity, on, you know, encounters with God, with this sort of sense of a kind of expansion and transformation of the self. And one of the things that I think has really marked off the last, say, 20 years of psychedelic culture in a distinctly kind of different direction, of course there's always overlaps and mixtures, is the increasing emphasis on the question of entities, of the encounter with otherworldly, disincarnate, alien, spectral entities, beings that seem to have something to say, that seem to have their own consciousness, their own will. And it's a really kind of interesting shift, because even if you go back and you know, like the Carlos Castaneda books were, of course, very popular in the 60s and 70s, and they were kind of de facto trip manuals for a lot of people trying to map these otherworldly spaces. And in there you have some sense of this kind of emerging shamanic worldview, or with more of an emphasis on a kind of on relationship to allies, is the word in Castaneda. And of course we have the great figure of the natural world of visionary experience, Mezcalito. But that aspect of modern psychedelic culture, because of course I'm not talking about traditional cultures here, has kind of really took off and has become more and more significant, I think, over the last 10, 20 years, partly with the rise of the shamanic metaphor. More and more people are thinking about their experiences, thinking about these realms in shamanic terms, as more and more people actually investigate shamanism, both living shamanic traditions and the history of shamanism, and both in the academy and out in the world of explorers, these sort of metaphors. And one of the things that goes along with the shamanic world is precisely this recognition or affirmation of a world of entities, and not just a world of entities, but an amoral world of entities, a world where you're not really sure what the status of these things are. Are they good? Are they bad? Are they neither? And it's really kind of a challenge to the traditional religious imagination in the West, where our entities are generally either angels or devils or maybe ghosts. And it's a really different kind of quality, and I'm really happy that we'll be able to explore some of these questions and more with our guest today, who's Dr. David Luke from the UK. But before I talk to him, I'm thinking of one other story I wanted to tell to kind of set it off. It's in Michael Harner's, not his first book, but his first sort of, you know, turn from academia, from being an anthropologist to being a sort of neo-shamanic teacher. And he talks about when he's down in the Amazon, and I think it's his first experience with ayahuasca, with drinking ayahuasca. And he goes and he sees all these entities, all these beings, and there were two that were particularly frightening and powerful to him. There were these tall, black winged malevolent spirits who told him that they were the lords of the realm that he was in. And later he, you know, comes down and he's talking to some missionaries. So he describes his experience, and the missionaries say, "Oh, see, they're the devils. Those are the demons that rule this realm of the imagination. You must stay away from these, you know, demonic Indian medicines. And so then he goes to the shaman, and he kind of describes the same story. And he says, yeah, and there were these two black-winged, dark figures who said, we are the lords of this realm. And the shaman laughed, and he said, ah, oh, those guys, they're always saying that. And there's something about that that captures the difference of the shamanic worldview, where there's all sorts of beings. You make relations with some, you avoid others, you make fun of others, you respect others. And it's a very different model, and it's one that I think is sort of becoming thicker and richer now as people explore ayahuasca and as psychedelic culture increasingly embraces a kind of shamanic frame of mind. But with that, we're going to move on and introduce first our co-host, the lovely Maja Dao, who's calling in from Los Angeles. Hello, Maja.
Hi, Eric.
Yeah, so what do you think? You think the topic of entities is an important one these days?
It's always important. I mean, I myself personally had an experience with entities that was pretty gnarly. When I was 16, I had a little death. I died a little bit on hallucinogenics, and I had an experience where these shadow men came and cut me up into little pieces and then put my body back together again. And then I had read a couple years after that the Mircea Eliade book, Rites and Symbols of Initiation, where he says, like, the shamans describe these shadow entities that are, like, kind of the ones behind the scenes that are the operators for a lot of the shamanic experiences. So, I mean, just like people will say they see things on drugs, but it goes a little deeper than that. And I think going into exploration of these entities is really helpful to help us wrangle these kind of shamanic experiences that we have with as a collective conscious, in our culture. And they are representative of angels and demons and ghosts and all of those things. And it's about, our relationship with them. So I think any kind of information we can get to these kind of outside entities that are behind the veil will only be helpful to us.
Well, great. That's a perfect introduction and segue into saying hello to David Luke. Hey, David, welcome to Expanding Mind.
Hi, Eric.
Hi, good to hear.
Hi.
So David's you're currently the president of the Parapsychological Association in the UK, and you lecture in psychology at the University of Greenwich, UK. So you're working this stuff from an academic and scholarly angle as well as a sort of cultural observer. But before we talk about this stuff, I'm kind of curious, just as sort of a gut feeling here, just to ask you, like, what is it in your own history, like when you reflect back, when you were a kid, when you were, growing up and starting to become interested in things, where do you see, like, the first stirrings of the kinds of interests that have led you to devote your life to these fringe but fascinating and necessary topics on the edge of psychology and spirituality?
It's a good question, Eric. I think I would struggle pinning it on any one thing, but essentially, as a child, like any child, I had extraordinary kind of hypnagogia and dream life, and would encounter all kinds of entities and beings in that space alone, which probably had a large part in leading me to explore these things more academically. Although, however, I will say that some teenage dalliance with altered states of a psychedelic variety also helped kickstart that particular path.
Absolutely. Well, tell me a little bit about what you do at the Parapsychological Association. I mean, parapsychology is such a fascinating, complex field, sort of hard to map what people actually do when you're working in it on a day-to-day basis. What are the kinds of projects that you're working on now?
Okay, well, the Parapsychological Association is more of a kind of virtual entity. It's a kind of professional body which kind of connects maybe 300 or so people researching this kind of area, this kind of liminal kind of zone of academia between physics and psychology primarily, although it kind of also incorporates areas of anthropology and other fields as well, of course. So I kind of headed that as a virtual entity, so that just kind of it was more of a figurehead position. But in my day-to-day academic studies within the laboratory, if you like, in Greenwich, I conduct experimentally controlled studies of primarily what we call psi. So this is, you know, clairvoyance, precognition, telepathy, this kind of thing. Almost exclusively, in fact.
So from your position as like the president of the association, where you can kind of see a lot, you know, a lot of different researchers, what they're kind of working on, are there trends now? Is there a certain conversation or question that people seem to be converging on? What feels like a kind of point of real provocative attention at this point?
That's a very good question. And I think, depending on who you ask, they'll have a slightly different answer, of course. Everyone has their own pet theories. But there seems to be a bit of a fervor bubbling up in trying to find some alignment with the field of physics and quantum physics and a kind of an ultimate answer to the question of what is reality, what is consciousness, how does it interact with the physical world. So getting at the kind of real gritty philosophical questions of the mind-body problem, and particularly the physicists at least are working towards integrating psychology with physics through parapsychology in many respects, perhaps looking at a way in which these bizarre phenomena that we study may be at the core of helping us to understand the relationship between mind and body, between matter and mind.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about some of your own work, and particularly this wonderful essay you wrote called Disembodied Eyes Revisited, an investigation into the ontology of entheogenic entity encounters. And as I was saying at the top of the program, this question of the status of these entities, their nature, is one of the most interesting ones. And so there's a lot of places we can go with it. But at first, I'd love to have you just kind of recount for us a little bit about your experiences and your research that led to this really provocative, wonderful essay.
Well, I'd say that this kind of research is a bit more off the tracks and over the fence at the edge of my field, pretty much, and kind of going into an explored territory, no man's land of academia. And it doesn't really fall within my kind of day-to-day experimental research in the laboratory. However, through psychonautic exploration of altered states and other realms, it's led me to have, as it has with you and Marja, encounters with what we might call entities, for want of a better word, free-floating, intelligent, seemingly beings, sentient beings, which we identify as being other than ourselves. And that's led me to ask several questions about the fundamental reality of those entities. What is the nature of their existence? Are they just neurochemical meddling with our kind of gray matter? Are they somehow a product of our own imagination, or do they exist somehow independently of us in some other hitherto undiscovered realm? This is kind of the core of our existence, our reality, our ontology. How do we work out who we are in relationship to these entities? What is the existence of those entities?
When you look into the history of the study of this and you look into, like, demonology, like, even in terms of, like, you know, medieval Renaissance-y type of thing, but going all the way back to the Greek daemon, one of the big questions was, are these entities outside of us or inside of us, right? And then that kind of leaves the whole alchemical predicament where everything is the same on the inside and the outside. It's just like this continual projection across, but one of the things I really like and think that is really a big core of the problem is looking at, are these entities even outside of us at all, or are they all aspects of ourselves that we come into confrontation with? And I think that is like kind of a big thing when you look at demonic exorcism that the shamans do, or like dealing with any of those entities in that kind of like deeper psychological framework.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a big kind of question mark and against the idea of inside and outside anyway. How can we really draw those kind of distinctions? Where does consciousness reside? It doesn't seem to be actually a part of the physical realm. Where does it exist in space? This is probably part of the problem itself. You know, when we're trying to explore the nature of these entities and inside and outside, we always end up back with the essential problem of, well, what is consciousness anyway? And where does it come from, and where does it exist, and how does it get there? Same with the entities. We're probably asking the same kind of question, essentially.
Well, one of the things I like about the whole question of entity and the sort of experiences that people relate is that these questions, of course, are perennial. They tend to be kind of abstract. As soon as you start to question like some of the fundamental presuppositions, you realize just how open-ended the discussion, the nature of consciousness and the nature of the other, et cetera, et cetera. But what's striking about these experiences is that in the experience, it's not just that, like, wow, I got some, bit of cosmic information, or I saw this incredible otherworldly landscape. It's that something else is looking at you. That sense of something being present is one of the most primary experiences that we have, and it really cuts through our chatter, our questions, our whatever else we might be thinking about. It's like, you walk into a room and you feel in there, you think the room's empty, and then suddenly you have a sense that you're being stared at, and you turn and there's somebody in the corner. Like that sense of an other being there, it cuts through like a lot of the questions and reflections that we might have, which is one of the reasons I think it's such an important place to pay attention to. And another thing that, and this leads more into the detail of the particular kind of figure that you encounter, which is one of the reasons that I was so fascinated by this article. And I do want to emphasize too that I recognize this is not the core of the psychological studies that you did, and this is more of a speculative, almost sort of creative, poetic exploration of possibilities rather than your day-to-day work as a parapsychology scientist. Nonetheless, it's just the particular figure that you meet. It's the way that you have a direct experience, in this case, this kind of creepy figure with eyes and snake-like body, and it seems totally bizarre and kind of horrifying, and you'd like to never see that thing again. And then you start doing research, and you realize that this something like this, this figure comes up in all these different kinds of traditions. So it's the way that our study of the traditions of human consciousness and mythology, our sense of these secret connections kind of going on beneath the surface, that's part of what drives us to really ask the question about whether these things reflect some greater reality than our own individual imaginations.
Yeah, sure. This is a question I'm fundamentally interested in. There's many questions, of course, but as a kind of parapsychologist, again, being around to play, I consider myself as much an ontologist as anything. What is the nature of reality? And so do these things genuinely exist? And for me to have an experience of encountering this googly-eyed, be-serpented kind of beastie at the edge of the realm, is one thing, but to then suddenly accidentally come across a number of other reports of other people encountering an entity which sounds very, very similar, it suddenly becomes a bit more unnerving. It suddenly gives it a whole new dimension. And when people report encounters with these things, they say they feel more real than real. They feel more real than this reality that we're in, our everyday existence. This act of being stared through, it makes them very real. So how can we determine, perhaps, well, how real are they? And if people have given up reports of encountering very, very similar entities and naively across, very many different cultures and across different times, does that lead to the supposition, perhaps, that they have some kind of independent existence? I wouldn't say it necessarily does, because we can never get past the kind of cultural influence. Perhaps this is some kind of primal experience of these eyes that people have in these altered states of consciousness, and that then, for a time immemorial, has embedded itself in the cultural record and found its way through history. But it's a fact, I would say, of a kind, that people genuinely have very similar experiences of these particular types of entities on certain substances, such as DMT. And what gives rise to that? This is the kind of perennial question. Is it something to do with our kind of basic biological makeup, some hard wiring in our brain, or is there some kind of genuine sentient existence of these things outside of that, outside of our brain?
Or that third spot in between where there's some, you know, you can think of Sheldrake's idea of the morphogenetic field, where there's some kind of collective organization of imagery and dynamics that isn't quite, ontologically defined the way that another person is, but it still has something that's much larger than any individual consciousness could come up with. Do you think there's any way to go farther with this question? I mean, you can do more research, you can get more data, you can have more and more accounts, you can look at more and more historical examples, but in some sense, is it just kind of a stuck question where you can't really go beyond this ambiguity?
I think not, and it's probably best left there in this kind of liminal zone of neither one nor the other. I mean, it gives rise to an unanswerable question. Although I will say, in support, I've been doing some research with a colleague, and he was looking at people's creativity, after taking ayahuasca, and people spontaneously started drawing more images of eyeballs after their ayahuasca sessions than in the control conditions or previously. So this would seem to suggest that for sure that there's a factoid there, that this kind of experience leads to this greater encounter with the thing with the eyes, whatever it is.
Yeah, and what really struck me, and just to be more personal about it, is I'm fascinated by this image of eyes, and I've had my own dreams and glimpses of images, particularly of the kind of geometries like in that Alex Gray painting that you cite in the article, Dying, where the guy's spirit is going up into this kind of mandala of almond shaped eyes. But really, again, what I reflect on with the eye is that if you think about one of the questions about entities, whether they're in psychedelic experiences or ghosts or even in dreams, to some extent, it's that sense when people talk about it, it's like, no. It was something else. It was not me. It was the other, the capital O. But if you boil down that sense, the sense of the other, it's not really in the body. It's not really in the way it moves. Maybe it's in the way that it speaks to you. But if there can be one sort of point of that sense of otherness, it's the eye. It's the idea that something is looking back at you. And so part of, for me, what's so enigmatic about this figure of these multiple eyes, whether it's attached to a snake-like body or whether it's the peacock, for example, which is an image I think is very fascinating, has a lot of resonance with a figure that you're talking about here, whether you have this sort of myriad eyes, is that the eyes remind you that's kind of like what the fundamental fact of this encounter is precisely this encounter with another. And like, what are you going to do with that? What are you going to do with the encounter of an other? Even if you never know whether it's real, whether it's your mind, nonetheless, there's something about encountering another, encountering an entity that calls us to respond, to work it out, to do something, whether it's creative or write an essay or explore the history of world mythology. There's something specific about that encounter over other kinds of paranormal experiences, to my mind, that's almost brought together with that image of the eyes. But tell me some of the things from world mythology that really struck you when you started to do your research on this figure.
Yeah, sure. So it seemed to me, it's easy just to project things into any kind of exploration into mythology, but it seemed to me that this particular entity seems to pop up in myriad forms in the mythologies of different cultures in Tibetan, in Middle Eastern cultures, often, you know, with the snake-like bodies, often with multitudinous eyes, and often in the same kind of role as this kind of psychopomp, as this kind of guardian of the threshold, as this entity that guards the way to the place you should not go, the one that guards the very ultimate threshold of our existence, of life and death, and often heralded as a kind of angel of death, as a kind of uber being of what occurs to us when we're going to die. And this is a kind of a perennial question as well. What happens when we die? You know, I mean, I guess we get to find out one day. Interestingly, I had a kind of extremely unnerving conversation with a small boy not so long ago who also told me how he'd encountered this thing aged 5 years old, and he regularly met him once a week in a hypnagogic trance, and that he had one eyeball for every soul there was in the afterlife. And this really put the willies up me, the way this kid just described this thing. Out of the blue, you know, it's like he's been having some kind of spontaneous DMT experience. Either that, he was very good at picking up what I was anticipating and reading my own mind in some kind of way, paranormal or otherwise, but he certainly put the willies at me in a way which is hard to fathom.
That's pretty remarkable. Seems like part of the world that one is initiated into through these encounters, because that's one of the ways I think about it, is that the experience of the encounter itself is a kind of initiation, but it's an initiation into an ambiguity, into something you can't really resolve, at least rationally. But it sets you off on a course. So one of the things that's great about your article is that we get to read as the readers, you doing the research, and as you go farther, it's like a Lovecraft story. As you go farther, you start to find in these obscure books this strange sense of possible connection. And as we go farther, we think more and more it becomes difficult to think that these things are just random firings of your neurons, and it's really more like a story. It's almost like we get initiated into a story of possibility rather than a philosophical understanding of the nature of reality. That seems foreclosed, but we get initiated into a kind of journey of the imagination.
I think it's a better way of looking at it, certainly, because there's no certainties to be had with this kind of philosophical pursuit, and it's probably best left in the realm of story and myth, you know, because it is a great story, and as is the story of our life, but to try and fathom it or pin it down is a fairly futile exercise, I think, in many ways. But I think
All right. Well, let's. We need to take a break now, so we'll come back and we'll talk more about other parapsychological stuff and other things that you're working on. This is Eric Davis. You're listening to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network with Maj Daou, talking to David Luke, and we'll be right back.
You are listening to the Progressive Radio Network, your number one source for progressive commentary.
The shaky economy, peak oil, and now an unstable climate. Get the inside story with Alex Smith on Radio EcoShock. Top scientists find a looming catastrophe while activists try for change. Experts, authors, and alternative media from around the world and around the corner. Hear it all. Radio EcoShock every Saturday afternoon at 2 o'clock. Listen free and live free right here on PRN, ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
Hello, this is Eric Ochsner, your host of the best jazz show on the air on Progressive Radio Network, Eric's Sounds of Jazz, every Friday night at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. I play the best jazz ever recorded by Louis, Sidney, Bessie, Billy, and all the others. Remember, Progressive Radio Network, Eric's Sounds of Jazz, every Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
Hi, I'm Eric Davis, host of Expanding Mind. Join me and co-host Maj Daou each week as we explore the culture of consciousness. spirituality, neuroscience, media tech, and all manner of wonders and esoterica. Expanding Mind streams every Thursday at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Keep your mind open.
Don't miss out on Dr. Michio Kaku's weekly show, Explorations. Dr. Kaku is the only scientist with his own nationally syndicated radio show. Explorations is the program that explains complex physics with an accessible approach. So take an exploration with Dr. Michio Kaku, Tuesdays at 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, to discuss topics ranging from space exploration to stem cell research.
The Progressive Radio Network is the home for progressive minds. It's the place where progressives get together to discuss important topics with informed opinions, minus the agenda. PRN is the place for fresh, stimulating, commercial-free radio content from leading progressives all over the world every day. The Progressive Radio Network, making the world a more informed place, one mind at a time.
Hi, this is Mike Fader. I'm doing a new show here on PRN every Thursday following Gary Null from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Time. It's called The Turning Point. What will we talk about? Well, everything from birth to death and most things in between. I'll be using stories in the news and personal observations from my own life. And from time to time, I'll be taking your calls. So please join me, Mike Fader, every Thursday from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Time for The Turning Point on PRN.
You are listening to the Progressive Radio Network, your number one source for progressive commentary.
On the Progressive Radio Network, I'm Maja Daou. We're here with Eric Davis, and we're talking about eyeballs and snakes. And David, you know, I kind of went through this path with the eyeball snake guys when I was studying Hermeticism a lot, because Hermes, who of course is the psychopomp, in Greek mythology, the fellow that he meets that kind of tells him what's going on is this thing called Poimanders, which is a serpent with a lot of eyes. And then I was like reading about that, and then I found out that angel descriptions are also these multi-eyed people. And I had that from like the Madeleine Lingle books from childhood, like Swiftly Tilting Planet. She talks about how the angels are these multi-eyed things. And that, it turned out, all came from Judaism and the Bible and these Jewish descriptions of the seraphim, which means, you know, fiery serpent with all these eyes. And I was just curious to kind of like put it back into the parapsychology realm. You know, obviously Carl Jung would take some of these entities that people would dream of, and he would kind of place it back into a practical framework. Like you were saying before the break, how it's kind of futile to try and like figure out the origin and causation of some of these meetings with these entities. But I was curious if you in your work and research have found a way to wrangle some of these maybe conversations with these entities into a practical framework where we can actually like get something or somewhere out of them. Like, have you found in any of your personal experiences even where those experiences with the entities were able to really kind of open you up as an individual or get you closer to somewhere in your identity or further your consciousness? Did you have any kind of experiences like that?
Well, yes, of course. It wasn't just all kind of hairy encounters with many-eyed, multiple-limbed beings, but some of them were very rich and served up some great information, which I believe helped me to develop. But I think where parapsychology can come in and bring something to the table here in this debate is in trying to explore the information that people can bring back from these encounters. After about 130 years of research with mediums, for instance, we've learned a few things about how to kind of conduct this kind of research and try to get to the bottom of the reality of those encounters. And it kind of ends up in a bit of an intellectual regress. And this the same issue applies from parapsychology research with mediums as it does researching these entities. For instance, there was a proposition put forward recently by a computer scientist, I believe, called Rodriguez, who suggested that we ask these entities some questions, you know, get them to solve some really hardcore math problems for us, and then boom shanker, that kind of gives away the idea that they are genuinely real if we could not work out this problem ourselves. And they give us the answer to this kind of question, then we've got a handle on what kind of shape or size these things really are. There's problems with that, though, of course, in that, for instance, I'll give you an example of the research conducted where a medium was playing a kind of a chess grandmaster, and the medium themselves, somebody communicates ostensibly with spirits of the dead, had no kind of chess experience, and they apparently were channeling the spirit of a dead grandmaster, and they played a game, and he fared pretty well, this medium. And the chess grandmaster, who was alive, said, well, I must have truly been playing with the spirit of this dead chess grandmaster. The problem being, of course, though, that the medium could have just been picking up the information from the guy sat opposite him across the table.
Right.
What we call clairvoyance, we know these things are possible, you know, years of remote viewing research and hundreds, if not thousands, of parapsychology experiments seem to suggest that we can access information from any place or space or time even. And so maybe this is just a demonstration of that, and not really communicating with a dead grandmaster at all. Does that help?
Well, yeah, I mean, in a way, it makes me, I'm curious how you think about what you're doing in parapsychology, because there are so many problems that almost shift away from the core question of whether these things are real to how do you deal with, like, the sociology of science? How do you deal with, like, evidence? How do you deal with epistemology? There's so many really complicated questions, and obviously, like, tons of really smart people have been banging away at it for a long, long time. And in a way, sometimes their research is not as appreciated or paid attention to because there's such a general culture of kind of poo-pooing that stuff. But it's also the case that there's something essentially slippery about the object in a way, and I'm just curious, like, as you've, you know, invested so much time in studying and studies with approaching these topics, how you've come to reflect on what it is that you're doing in terms of using scientific methods, asking rational questions, getting to the edge of these ambiguities, and how what the way forward is.
Right. Sure. Well, that's a big question. I wish I knew the answer to, really, in many ways. But thinking about the sociology of science, yeah, this is kind of hugely problematic, and you can see that science progresses in, we'd like to think it progresses in a way which reflects the kind of reality of the universe and the kind of impartial quest for truth, but it doesn't, unfortunately. You know, the gatekeepers of science, of orthodox science, can close ranks whenever they want and say this is taboo, and they have done for a long time, and that really thwarts kind of getting to the nub of a lot of these questions. But for me, in terms of how I kind of grapple with this completely slippery bar of psychic soap as a person, it's quite a difficult task. I have to kind of wear many hats. One is a scientist, and then I kind of take that off and just have a long, good laugh, you know, regularly, because these things are so slippery. It's like we're dealing with consciousness itself. We're trying to trap it in a box and kind of describe it, but we're dealing with our own consciousness. I mean, one of the problems within parapsychology is what appears to be a kind of experimental effect. It's, well, the side we're demonstrating, you know, this precognition or whatever it is in the laboratory may actually just be our own psychic abilities. We're just creating the results we want, so we can never really be certain where these effects are coming from, which, you know, throws all of your standard scientific principles pretty much out of the window. It's like trying to wrestle with the punchline of the cosmic joke. got the better of it, you know.
Well,
that's
yeah,
so funny. It must be at once frustrating and constantly titillating, like to be in that process on a kind of daily basis.
Well, I'm curious, like, what if you look at it not from, like, so much trying to figure out, like, the cause and origination of these, but actually, like, looking at the results, like, the effects of it. Like, I know a lot of parapsychology is trying to figure out that place in consciousness that it comes from and causes it, and if you can repeat it and how you can control it. But do you guys ever just look at, like, the results of it? Like, if someone, like, totally changed their lives or solved some psychological issue they'd had since their childhood? Like, what kind of statistics do you guys have for entity research where people have, like, you know, dealt with these kind of things and it actually, you know, pummeled them into this new echelon of their existence? Does that ever go into the research and your experiments at all?
Yeah, I'm kind of much more of an experimentalist, but that kind of research does go on. Not in great quantity, unfortunately. I think there's, you know, there's little pockets of research going on in this area, but it's essentially, you know, a taboo region of science. For one thing, parapsychology is. The other thing, psychedelics are taboo, and entities are really taboo. You know, you pull those three things together, and, you know, you really are on the fringe of scientific exploration. Not that it doesn't make it any less legitimate,
right.
But it's not so many people doing this kind of research. But I think people do have these experiences and do grow from them. There's a lot of research coming out, not so much parapsychological, but looking at the use of ayahuasca, which is seems to be a cause célèbre at the minute. Everybody seems to be now conducting research in the area of ayahuasca because people have such extraordinary experiences with this. They have transformations. There's a kind of rich field of data to mine there, really. Certainly, these experiences can be completely transformational. You know, Terence McKenna kind of mischievously said, at a certain dosage, DMT will make turn any atheist into a kind of believer. And I think, that's probably taken it a bit far, but I think there's some relevance to that, in that these experiences are so profound and extraordinary, people do scrabble around to find places to put them in, and it can lead people to ask more questions, and B, perhaps move towards a kind of a more whole position, you know, to reflect upon their being and where they are in life and their own existence, their own death, their own life, these big questions. And I think there can be some something very positive in that experience and that journey.
Well, you brought up the issue of death a couple of times, and I'm just curious, just from your work as a parapsychologist, but also just someone who's clearly, you know, invested and interested in that larger process of transformation that remains elusive in a lot of ways. How do you think these tools and these questions help us sort of sneak up to the edge of death?
Well, you know, in the shamanic tradition, they would say, well, some would say, obviously, that if you go into these realms, you are passing beyond the gate of death without actually physically having to die. You are in communication with the spirits of the dead and the underworld. This is from one kind of perspective, of course. And certainly it gives people a chance to reflect upon their own death, whether or not they really are going to the realm of the dead or not. If you have an experience of which you have died physically and been reborn, although you didn't actually die, then that is a useful experience to help you reflect and come to terms with your own death. Some of the research that's going on currently, looking at the use of psychedelics in the alleviation of kind of end-of-life anxiety is very promising, I think. I mean, this was done in the 60s, and it's finally seeing a bit of a renaissance now, and this research is going on once again. And I think psychedelics probably do have a very useful role in helping people to come to terms with the end of their life.
I'm curious also whether you feel like like you mentioned, you talked before about how these questions are kind of, are very fringe from the perspective of quote unquote normal psychology, normal science, you know, the psychedelics at all, obviously the question of entities, but even some of these claims of transformation and healing are, you know, of course very suspect. Do you feel like on the one hand that it feels like as we go forward and as more and more information builds up and as science continues to change and as our whole world is changing so rapidly in terms of information in the future, et cetera, that these topics will become more central, that they will become more recognized, that in some sense psychedelics will have like a place at the table? Or do you feel that it's almost their job, at least as long as we still live in a modern rationalist world to some degree, as long as we're still kind of in this modern paradigm, that it's their job to always remain a little bit on the edge, to be sort of liminal, sort of fringe, but kind of pulling people across that line or suggesting different ways of thinking about the world?
Yeah, absolutely, and I think that's always been their role in many respects. Even in the kind of shamanic cultures that use them, the shaman is a very liminal character, and to enter into these realms is to push the boundaries of awe. And I think that that's, in many respects, they will remain there in some sense. Certainly, I think I'd like to see scientific research with these substances come back into the table, but the substances themselves and the people they attract to do the research, well, that can still remain a kind of liminal endeavor, but I think they have a valuable role in society in some respects. I think certainly to put them into shadow is detrimental. They are many things, and you know, one of the things I'm interested in is exploring, well, what are psychedelics? What do they mean to different people? I mean, everybody has staked a claim on them in some way, you know, from historians to scientists to shamans to psychonauts. They mean so many different things to many different people, and I think there's a role there for them.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I keep wondering whether, you know, as neuroscience keeps making its march, and you know, like so many, you know, to some degree reductionist languages, it tends to have kind of an imperialist quality where it wants to like expand into all realms, so that you know every little quirk or poem or you know philosophical insight of the human experience can be reduced to some kind of you know function of the brain. But I kind of wonder, like as that goes forward and as a lot of information builds and a lot of acute ways of looking at the world are refined, I mean at some point they have to look at the psychedelic conundrum head on. I mean, you can't avoid it just from a pure scientific point of view. It's like you have to account for dreams, you have to account for deja vu, you have to account for the appearance of telepathy and clairvoyance. You know, you might be able to write them off based on this and that, but you need to get deeper and get into kind of the brain mechanism. So at some point, I just don't understand how any neuroscientist or you know cognitive scientist, psychologist who's working at these issues of altered states, how they possibly avoid this colossal of the DMT flower, part of their attempt to reduce world to brain mechanisms. So I always wonder whether there's some kind of like collision coming where it's like they can't, you know, the cat's out of the bag. But I also know too much about how science works to really believe it's going to happen anytime soon, at least in a big way.
I think you're feeling, beginning to feel an inkling of it now. And I really do invite neuroscientists to don their reductionist armor and dive in and really kind of get and pick the issues such as this, you know, to embrace the psychedelic experience and try and just explain it away. I think would do a disservice to it, but I think it's probably going to be one of the biggest challenges for neuroscience in many respects. How's it going to deal with this really messy, sprawling, endless kind of experiential realm that can cause out of these substances? How are people going to kind of grapple with that and explain it in terms of just pure reductionist science. Can we really just do that? Will they do that? Will they, or will they embrace it and really try and learn to understand what these experiences are and not just call them hallucination, which has been a kind of wastebasket term for these experiences from mainstream science for the last few decades at least. Let's not just call it hallucination. Let's kind of get to the nitty-gritty. Let's unpack these experiences and really try and understand what's going on.
Well, along those lines, what do you think of James Kent's psychedelic information theory? We had him on the show, and he has a kind of reductionist materialist bent, but he's obviously not sitting there trying to destroy the interest in these experiences, and he's in some ways coming from more of an underground perspective. How did you find his account of the sort of psychedelics in the brain?
Yeah, I thought it was really good. I thought James had maybe kind of softened his opinions a little bit. I mean, he didn't seem to be saying outright that these elves that DMT created just purely random neurochemical firing. He seemed to have at least moved a little closer to the threshold of weirdness and suggested that they are information generators without actually saying whether that means they exist or not. And he even kind of came to accept the idea, from my understanding, that they can provide useful information, but pretty much most of the time they're tricksters. So he's at least lending them the language of a kind of independent entity with some variety. And he's certainly not denouncing them anymore. But I was very intrigued by his position on them. I think he seems to trying to get around the issue without really saying that they exist or not, which is probably the best place to stand.
Yeah, I found his his investigations very interesting. But we just have a few minutes left on the show, and I'm just wondering if you want to talk a little bit more about what projects are. You got a couple conferences coming up, other places people might be able to turn to look at your work and things you think are interesting in the field.
Sure. I'm kind of co-editing a pretty funky website called brainwaving.com, which covers all things consciousness, neuroscience, psychedelics, and beyond. We've got a conference in the University of Kent. I think it's probably the first ever psychedelic conference in the UK hosted by a university. Certainly don't recall any others in my living history. And we've got about 30 invited speakers coming from across the globe and about 50 submissions from academics and artists and other kinds of people. So it's going to be a pretty big event at the beginning of April. On the kind of flip side of that, I'm also co-organizing a parapsychology conference down in Brazil. So opportunities there for a kind of more experiential journey into some of the stranger realms of consciousness as well.
What is some of the most interesting stuff that's happening in terms of like ayahuasca research? I mean, I know there's a tremendous amount of anthropologists and psychologists looking at them, particularly in Brazil. A lot of it's I think in Portuguese, but I also get the sense that there's actually quite a lot of work that's happening right now in a scientific framework.
Yeah, very much. I'd say most of it is kind of cast within the field of anthropology, but it's kind of diverse. Certainly there's a lot of psychopharmacological questions yet to be answered, and there's some researchers in kind of Finland and Spain and elsewhere doing research on that. And I think slowly we're kind of moving in on this particular realm of understanding and trying to unpack it a little bit more. But I would say most of the work going on is anthropological, certainly the stuff I'm primarily interested in. And there's even one parapsychological study going on as well, believe it or not. That's my own, actually, but that's...
that's good. I do believe it then. Finally, after this whole conversation of ambiguity, I can believe something. Well, David, thanks so much for talking to us on Expanding Mind. I'll say goodbye.